C1B, 1 and 2.
Number 6B.
Then we come to the subtone of truth. And we have seen the moment we come to the subtone of truth, what would she have to tell us? We said always in truth, she begins, she tells, that under the consciousness of truth, the consciousness of the error disappears, whatever then that error is. Here naturally it would be on the tone of spirit, where she would say that to spiritual consciousness, the immortal facts of being are real. We are in reality. The question is reality of the whole subject of spirit. And this very consciousness dissolves the contrary dualism of pantheistic beliefs. We noted all over now that pantheism is the counterfeit of spirit, because pantheism says that the spirit of God dwells in every object. The mingling of spirit and matter, that's pantheism. And now here would come up the question, but how can we see how that pantheistic belief in reality, that matter has spirit within itself, that the spirit dwells in matter, and therefore that matter seems to have a reality, how can that belief of this pantheistic reality disappear? The answer is spiritual consciousness. If you're entertaining consciousness but spiritual ideas and spiritual realities, you cannot at the same time entertain in consciousness a wrong sense of reality. And that is the reason why it disappears. There is no mystical trick in it why matter should disappear. It is a very logical process to see that if consciousness is full of ideas, of the realities, of the spiritual realities, then it cannot at the same time be full of the counterfeit beliefs. So consciousness makes matter disappear. There is no mystical trick that is being played somewhere that makes the matter disappear, just as in the little story of Alice in the Wonderland, that Cheshire Cat just begins to disappear, taking away first the tail and then the legs and then the body and then the head and then finally even take away the grind. It is saying your consciousness determines how much that Cheshire Cat disappears, how much the appearance of matter disappears. So she starts out with a very interesting marginal heading of spiritual tangibilities. There is some, if the spiritual tangibility becomes bigger and bigger in consciousness, then we have no more material tangibilities, because they exclude each other by the very nature of. So she goes on and says, for immortal consciousness, therefore that spiritual consciousness, ideas are tangible and real and eternal. They are tangible and real and eternal. We begin to see now we get hold of the substance of reality through consciousness. He says in immortal consciousness they are real. It's very, very nice to see now, as the subtone of truth, that it says that reality is only a matter of consciousness. You cannot determine objectively if matter is real or unreal. You can only detect it subjectively through your consciousness, how much matter seems to be real to you and how much matter is no more real to you, how much spirit is tangible to your senses and how much spirit is intangible to your senses. That's a matter of consciousness. So this is interesting here, because she tells here then that these pantheistic beliefs are contradiction of revelation. And she speaks about contradiction. Can you see why? What is a contradiction? Contradiction is when something that is stated that it is not, that something which is true is stated it is not true. And you come to the question of truth again, where one sees, oh yes, that contradiction can only go on if you are outside the controversy. Then you can look at one argument which says this statement is real, and you can look at the other argument which states this statement is unreal. But if one makes it subjective to consciousness, we can't do that anymore. The moment we make it subjective to us, we are, so to say, the standpoint, and if we see that spirit is the real, we cannot at the same time state the opposite, because the statement is a subjective vision, a subjective consciousness. And so she can always see that those subtones of truth, as you will go on, then every time that subtone of truth comes in, there are the most interesting reasonings there. Because there, you see, is the piece where the error begins to disappear. And the reasoning that error disappears before truth is a statement. She must reason it out why an error disappears before truth. And so here, at the point of spirit, she explains it very nicely and says, you know, it is just a matter of consciousness here, why error appears before truth. It is that pantheistic belief which is a contradiction in itself, and therefore truth that is one valued, which only knows truth, cannot know a contradiction, and because it cannot know a contradiction, there can be no dualistic nature, truth and error. It's not possible. So when she says, when pantheistic beliefs disappear, then the immortal facts of being are seen. So again, what is it that makes us realize the facts of being? That the facts of being are the only facts? Is it because those facts exist? She says, no, not because those facts exist, but because you are conscious of these facts. That's why they exist. Cogito ergo sum, the old thing. What I have in consciousness, that I am. What I have in consciousness, that is true. That is my universe. So, in the measure as in consciousness, the pantheistic beliefs, see, this is a pantheistic consciousness. In the measure as the pantheistic consciousness disappear, in that measure, I have only the one valued reality. Then I see reality, the immortal facts of being. Therefore, can you see that so-called material reality does not disappear before the realities of spirit, just because it is an opposite? It is stating how it can disappear and says, actually, what seems to be a material reality is not the material objective reality, it's a belief, it's a pantheistic belief. Therefore, with consciousness I can overcome or replace pantheistic beliefs, and then I have only the one valued nature of spirit. Yeah? Okay. So, she goes on to love, and in love we would always see the all and the nothing. We will see the allness of the reality of spirit, the nothingness, really, of matter. I've epitomized it like this: from spirit, only reflections of good can come. Matter is unknown. See, at this point, matter is unknown. Up to this point, she didn't say matter is unknown. She said matter does not mingle with spirit, as if she would accept that there is something like matter that cannot mingle with spirit, as if they were two substances. And so little by little, through the whole law, she began to explain why that is not possible, and that at the point of truth, saying, actually, matter is only a contradictory belief, a pantheistic belief. If you take that pantheistic belief away and replace it through a spiritual consciousness, then you arrive at love, where you see, then you, in that spiritual consciousness, only the reflection of spirit are there, and they are good. And then in that spiritual consciousness, matter is unknown, is not a state of consciousness anymore, because your consciousness at that point is only spiritual. Her reasoning is here on the marginal heading, the things of God are beautiful. She reasoned it out like this. She says, in the infinitude of mind, matter must be unknown. Must be unknown. You can't help it. Because infinitude of mind, you only have that consciousness that only is engaged in contemplating spiritual ideas, therefore constituting your spiritual consciousness. He says, in that mind, no symbol of discord and decay can enter. Not even a symbol of discord and decay can enter. You just have the purity of the ideas. Just the purity of the ideas. So you have only the reflections of good. Good is spirit. All things beautiful are ideas of mind. And you have just one realm, the ideas of spiritual ideas, and no more realm of matter. Yes. So that is the story. Perhaps we just run through it quickly, summarizing it as we have it on page 6. We are faced, therefore, here with a great proposition. Is there a material reality, or is there a spiritual reality, or is there a spiritual and a material reality? This great question. So she solves this by saying, like produces like. Therefore, mind can only produce ideas of mind. Mind cannot produce its likeness, matter. Nor can matter really produce its unlikeness, mind. Like produces like. Mind produces ideas. Matter produces its own likeness. Never ideas. All right. Having stated that, she comes in and says, and you know, spirit producing ideas, and only ideas, is giving us the realm of reality. That's real. Whereas the material universe is unreal. If one is real, the other must be, the opposite must be unreal. Therefore, in soul, we see that one reality therefore explains away the other sense of reality, that spirit explains away substance matter. How? By rising above physics into metaphysics. Having risen above physics into metaphysics, she comes to principle and says, has metaphysics a principle behind itself? And has physics also a principle behind itself, a basis, a cause, a foundation behind itself, on which it can stand, which supports it? It says, no. Only the spiritual has a principle behind itself. Matter cannot fall back on a divine principle. Matter has no footing, no foothold, so to say, in a divine principle. Okay, if matter has nothing to stand upon, then it must fall to pieces. So it comes to life and shows, therefore, alone the spiritual reality is eternal, and the material so-called reality falls to pieces, is doomed to decay. Okay, then she comes to truth and says, but you know, everything is a matter of consciousness. About what are you conscious of? Are you conscious of all that what has been shown to be idea? Or have you been conscious of all that has been shown to be a belief? If you are conscious of only the spiritual reality, you cannot at the same time be conscious of a so-called material existence, and therefore that spiritual consciousness resolves the belief in a material reality. If material reality is dissolving to the point of absolute dissolution, you come to love where you see, oh yes, only that which reflects spirit is really real and factual, and in that light of the infinite reflection of spirit, nothing material appears, and therefore it is unknown. Now this is a process that we can go over individually at home over and over, and we will feel the more we go along that law and see that the spiritual at the point of principle has a principle behind itself, therefore is the eternal at the point of life, and therefore that we should only be conscious of that eternal principle point, that finally leads us to a consciousness where we only see the reflections of good that are beautiful, and in that consciousness we are no more aware of matter. And no more being aware of matter is really dissolving matter. If we want to get rid of matter, we don't have to knock down a material thing. If we want to get rid of a material concept of our body, or a material concept of man, or a material concept of anything, we cannot solve that question just by trying to knock that material proposition to pieces. That is not destroying matter. Destroying matter has now been shown to be destroying a material belief about anything. So we are not going to destroy our body because the body seems to be a material proposition. We are going to see that that body is not a reality, a material reality. Therefore, we have to see that we get rid of a false belief about body being a reality and beginning to see that that body cannot do anything without our consent. So that we are resolving the belief in matter in the first place, and only if we resolve the belief in matter, we resolve the question of matter, because then matter is unknown. We don't even have then anymore an enemy called matter, which we have to knock down as fast and hard as possible. Yes. So we go to the next one, and we run quickly through the one on soul. We do that again as if we just would make a scientific exercise. We know now already what is coming, and we train ourselves and culture ourselves in the tonality of that law. And the proposition that is put in front of us now in soul is the belief, the universal belief, that everything is limited, has a limitation, in place and time, in space and time, that it has material limitations, that everything somehow is restricted to limitation. But soul says, I'm always outside body. It says that soul is never in anything. So if ever we want to get a true idea of anything, it must be the idea of limitlessness, that everything we contemplate, whatever the problem is, that we see it as an idea that is unlimited, and therefore dissolve within ourselves that very problem which we are considering has a belief of limitations. It's again taking off the limits that really bring forth true creation. We can see any problem, whatever the problem is. It doesn't need to be a problem in the range of the synonymous term soul. It can be any problem. But every problem seems to have limits. And that we suffer because it puts limits on our consciousness. We have to take off those limits, and that is what Mrs. Eddy shows here. How can we free ourselves of a limited concept and gather an unlimited concept? Therefore, it is quite natural that you would start with that concept and with beliefs and would show in mind first that the divine mind is always unlimited, is always infinite. And therefore, the opposite of mind as a contrapoint is beliefs, that human beliefs always are characterized by being limited, and that they always like to divide up and up and up, because through division we can limit even more. The more we divide, the more parts we have, the more limitations we have, And so this is a general belief within mankind. And you can see how she expresses this concept. I follow now the reasoning of her. Fundamentally, again, she has to contrapoint, so to say, mind and beliefs. She says mind is infinite, whereas we have to do with a lot of finite beliefs. She says, how does that happen, these finite beliefs? She says, they limit all things. They would compress mind beneath a skull bone. See, that's a limitation. And that with beliefs, with finite beliefs, therefore we cannot apprehend the infinite. That with finite beliefs we can never really get hold of the infinite idea. And therefore beliefs seek to divide soul, which is infinite, and substance into souls, and seek to divide the one spirit into persons and soul. Now, you cannot mistake, when you read this paragraph, you can't mistake, that she speaks constantly about limiting, that beliefs are geared to the aim of limiting, dividing. Whereas, on the other side, she states the fact of divine mind and says, the divine mind is infinite, it cannot be divided up. Then she goes to spirit and shows, therefore it is so, that there is only one spirit, one God, indivisible, you cannot split it up. That's the thing, that's the real thing. Whereas the beliefs that try to split up, to make gods many, spirits many, minds many, split up, divide, is not the real thing. They are not our God. They are gods and lords many. Therefore, in the text, you hear that tone running through it, which says, thou shalt have no other God before you. You only have to have one God, not many gods. Human belief, she says, wants to create all these unreal gods, has gods many, lords many, minds many, put soul into body and spirit and life into finite forms. And you see, the side note here is belief in many gods. So here you have a description how we should only have one spirit, one God. Where is your heart? With the one God. Where is your value? With the one spirit. What do you really evaluate and value in your life? What do you feel is the facts and the reality of being? Only to have one God, and all the other one is many gods, many lords, many minds, many bodies, as your false gods, as your unreal gods. Yes. Then we come to soul, and we would expect that in soul we would see that soul and its qualities are supreme over the limitations, over corporealities. Therefore, the marginal heading, sensationless body, because we live not in body, but outside the body, above the body, so to say. We have a sensationless body, and so she says that God is the soul of man and of all existence. Spirit and matter do not commingle. When one appears, the other disappears. Gives us a sense that we are living outside the body, that God is the soul of man. It's now no more. We have a soul. Each man has its own soul within himself. Now you lift it right out of the concept that the soul lives within us and say, God, that which is outside, which is infinite, is the soul of man. Quite a terrific statement.